calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone in the Willamette Valley, right on the banks of the Willamette River, actually, in Portland, Oregon. Welcome back to our program, or welcome to our program on this beautiful Monday, the 29th of August, 2005, as New Orleans is being battered by one of the most severe hurricanes in American history, or at least it was at sea yesterday. It has now been downgraded to a Category 3 hurricane, Katrina, but still a serious problem. A very serious problem. In fact, perhaps one of the serious problems, a symptom of, shall we say, of larger and more serious problems to come. For example, this from Ross Gelbspan's website. Ross is the guy who wrote The Heat Is On, and his website is heatisonline.org. In the 1980s, well, actually, let me just give a little background on this. Turns out that as the climate warms up, as the atmosphere warms up, it is acquiring or holding more heat. More carbon dioxide in the atmosphere causes the atmosphere to allow sunlight in and to warm the surface of the Earth, but it doesn't allow radiated heat out as easily. So it acts like a sort of like a greenhouse, like the glass on a greenhouse. It lets the heat in, but it doesn't go out. Right? And so as more heat accumulates in this very, very thin layer, this 5 mile thick layer, just think how far 5 miles is. I mean, you can ride 5 miles on your bike in 10 minutes, 15 minutes. You can walk 5 miles in just a little over an hour. You can drive 5 miles in 5, 10 minutes. Well, at 60 miles an hour, you can drive 5 miles in 5 minutes. That is the distance from the bottom, from ground level to the top of our atmosphere. The top of the high end of the troposphere, the top of the atmosphere, really the stratosphere, the atmosphere that protects this Earth. There's little fringes that go up above that, certainly, but the vast majority of the atmosphere is within that first 5 miles. And as that little thin eggshell-like layer of air that surrounds this great big planet fills up with more and more carbon dioxide from our burning coal and oil and other fossil fuels, gasoline, well, it's all variations on oil. And also, as other heat holders, as other greenhouse gases are released, some of them chemicals that are the result of industrial production, some of them, most of them actually from natural sources, that are the result of the global warming in the first place. There's enormous amounts of carbon, particularly in the form of methane, which is, my recollection, either 10 or 20 times more effective than carbon dioxide at trapping heat as a greenhouse gas, a very, very powerful greenhouse gas, methane. Enormous amounts of methane that are trapped in or can be released as it decomposes in bogs, in peat bogs and in tundra, that is in the frozen soil of the north. Land that has not been unfrozen in 10,000, 20,000, 50,000, thousands and thousands of years, in many cases. And as this stuff starts to melt, and it is, the permafrost is melting across Siberia, across Alaska, across northern Europe. As the permafrost melts, it releases more methane and more carbon dioxide into the air, and you have what's called a positive feedback loop. Now, positive feedback loops are really important to understand because most people who don't really get it about climate change and what it all means don't understand the difference between a positive feedback loop and a negative feedback loop. A negative feedback loop is like the thermostat in your home. The way the thermostat in your home works is it notices that it's cold and you need more heat. And so it turns itself on, right, two little strips of metal, of dissimilar metal, bend as a result of temperature, or you've got, and they either cause a contact to close, or they flip a little glass tube full of mercury, and in any case, they turn on your furnace. And heat comes in, and as the heat comes in, the metal bends in the other direction until it's the right temperature, and then it turns, it disconnects from the contact, and it shuts down your furnace. That's a negative feedback loop. In other words, as the heat increases, the negative pressure on the thermostat increases to the point where eventually you get enough heat that the thermostat says, okay, enough already, and shuts down the furnace. And what it does is it regulates temperature. That's a desirable thing. Now, a positive feedback loop would be if the thermometer, if your thermostat said, okay, we need some heat, and the heat came on, and your thermostat was wired backwards, so that the more heat there was, the harder it was pushing on the give me more heat button. And what would happen? Your house, your furnace would run continuously, and your house would get warmer and warmer and warmer. That's a positive feedback loop. In other words, the increase in heat produces a positive pressure for more heat. And that's what we have right now in the climate. Heat in the climate, in this eggshell thin layer of air surrounding our planet, additional trapped heat, which is the result of additional quantities of carbon dioxide and methane and other greenhouse gases, in addition to natural variations. I mean, we have to give ExxonMobil their due. There are natural variations in this thing. But when you combine those with the additional carbon dioxide, you have this positive feedback system where it warms up the Earth. As it warms up the Earth, then instead of a negative feedback, instead of a regulatory mechanism kicking in and saying, oh, well, let's cool things down, instead what happens, or let's reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the air, instead, what happens is things start happening that actually continue to increase the release of carbon dioxide and methane, such as the melting of the tundras. As the oceans get warmer and warmer, there's billions, perhaps trillions of tons of what are called methane hydrate crystals. Crystals of methane and other carbon-based gases that have been liquefied and then solidified, and they form crystals, and they're at the bottom of the ocean, and many of them along the continental shelves. And as the ocean warms up, these methane hydrate crystals warm up, and they become liquid, and then they become gaseous, and they bubble up to the surface and bubble up out of the ocean. And there's a big concern that if the land-based positive feedback loop, that is to say, if the increasing temperature increases the rate at which the tundras thaw and melt, which increases the release of methane and carbon dioxide, which increases the temperature, as that increases in turn the temperature of the oceans. And keep in mind, it's the 90-degree temperature of the water in the Gulf of Mexico right now. That water is literally 90 degrees. As that warm water in the Gulf feeds its heat into the atmosphere above it, that's what's feeding this hurricane, or what was feeding it until it hit land. As the deeper parts of the ocean start to warm, there's a very real concern in scientific circles that what is sometimes referred to as the soda pop hypothesis may happen. And this could be an absolute disaster. The soda pop hypothesis is that the ocean will warm up to a point that these crystals, these methane crystals at the bottom of the sea will start liquefying and then gasifying, and they'll just start bubbling up out of the ocean, and the ocean will become fizzy like soda pop, releasing billions of tons of carbon dioxide into the air. And we'll be back, instead of at, 300 in the high 300 range parts per million of carbon dioxide in the air as we had in 1900, or the 410, 420, 430 parts per million of carbon dioxide that we have in the atmosphere, we've seen increasing over the last 20, 30 years, that we could go to 500 or 600 parts per million, of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as we had during the Carboniferous period 500 million years ago. Well, 300, from 500 to 300 million years ago. And it was a very different climate. I mean, this was before the dinosaurs. And a lot of life forms that are currently on Earth would simply not be able to adapt to that climate. So the danger in this is that it's this self-perpetuating process. The Bush administration, of course, sitting around going, there's nothing to worry about. Right? Dick Cheney coming out with his energy policy. What's his energy policy? Burn more fossil fuels. And by the way, let's take some of those tax dollars and give them to the fossil fuel companies. Just what they need. $11 billion in our tax money. But the reality is that as the atmosphere warms up, and this is where I started with this whole rant, as the atmosphere warms up, heat is a form of energy. Heat, at its most fundamental level, is expressed in things like atmospheres by the motion of atoms and molecules. They bounce around more rapidly as a consequence of heat. You cool things down, they bounce around more slowly. Good old Brownian motion, you know, the speed of it changes as a function of temperature. And so as temperature goes up, the amount of energy in the atmosphere goes up. As the amount of energy in the atmosphere goes up, the severity of storms increases. The extremes of weather increases. Weather patterns change. Places that were green become desert. Places that were desert become washed away. Places that were frozen become melted. And perhaps if the Gulf Stream collapses, and there's a lot of talk about the possibility of that, of the Gulf Stream collapsing, if the Gulf Stream collapses, then places that were temperate, like Europe, could become glaciated. Now, the insurance industry is a little worried about this. As Ross Gelbspan notes on his website, in the 1980s, the world's property insurers lost an average of $2 billion a year to damage claims from extreme weather events. $2 billion a year. In the 1990s, that was in the 1980s. In the 1990s, those losses averaged more than $12 billion a year. And now, just a quick perusal of the headlines, we see The Washington Post today, Katrina may cost insurers $25 billion. So we've gone from $2 billion a year in the 1980s to $12 billion a year in the 1980s. Now, part of that, of course, is that the dollar doesn't buy what it used to. Part of it is that, you know, development has increased the value of things. But an awful lot of it here. Reuters, Katrina may cost insurers $30 billion. Talk about your economy taking a hit. A serious hit. Not to mention the loss of oil supplies and gasoline supplies. Have you filled up your car today? 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. It is 24 and a half minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. And our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, toll-free coast-to-coast, our chat room, tomhartman.com. Click on the live chat button. It'll get you there. And one of the folks, Mud Mike, in our chat room, wrote the following letter, which his local newspaper actually printed. I'm looking at it on the web. It was the Morning Call, his local newspaper. It doesn't say, let's see what town this is. I hate it when local newspapers have great websites and then they don't say, you know, it's Allen Township, but I'm sure Michael let me know in the chat room. Anyhow, here's the letter. Let the wacky liberals keep to themselves is the headline. And he writes the letter. Those wacky liberals keep questioning President Bush. They question that the invasion and occupation of Iraq was part of the war on terror. Of course, it is an integral part of the war on terror. Had we focused on getting Osama bin Laden, we would have run out of terrorists by now. We need to create more terrorists by killing Iraqi civilians. You can't have a war without an enemy! Exclamation mark. Those commies question the relationship between Iraq and World War II. Don't they remember that in 1941, FDR responded to Pearl Harbor by invading Peru? Those traitors complain that we are not bringing freedom to Iraq. We are freeing the Shiites to practice their religion and force their beliefs on the rest. Iraqi women got to vote, and the new constitution will free them from having to vote, or having to work outside the home, or going out in public alone. We're also freeing the Shiites to form alliances with Iran. I hope that those wacky commie traitor liberals shut up and enjoy their freedom to keep their misinformed views to themselves. I love it. It's great. Well done, Mike. Allentown, Pennsylvania is the newspaper. Hey, well done, Michael. Good on you. Good job. I love it. Oh, my. And Katrina. Katrina is bashing New Orleans, the whole Gulf Coast, as we speak. Our prayers and best wishes are with all the people there. So far, the Superdome is holding up. A few holes in the roof. But the thing is, and the storm has downgraded to a Category 3. Apparently, once it hit land, it started to, I wouldn't say fall apart, but it started to diminish in severity substantially. But this is an indication of something much larger that, you know, I've been telling you about for a long time, and there's a whole chapter about it in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And that is that the weather is changing. And, you know, even George Bush now has acknowledged, hey, the weather's changing, although he's saying, well, you know, it's an act of God, you know. But no. It has to do with something that we're doing. We have put about a trillion barrels of oil worth of carbon and carbon dioxide, oil is, you know, mostly carbon, into the atmosphere since 1856, when Colonel Drake drilled the first oil well in Titusville, Pennsylvania. A trillion barrels. It's estimated there's another trillion barrels still in the ground, maybe half to two-thirds of which we can probably extract. And, you know, which might be enough at the current rates of consumption to last us, according to British Petroleum's website, not exactly, you know, your basic green organization, might last us somewhere between 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Depends on how quickly we consume it. Depends on whether the rate of consumption continues to go up. Of course, these higher prices are going to reduce consumption somewhat. But to a large extent, I mean, let's be honest, the increase in the price of oil does not so much reflect the value of oil and the scarcity of oil yet. That's still coming. As it does the decline in the value of the dollar. Because in 1980-81, we saw gas prices that in today's dollars were $3.05 a gallon. So, you know, what we're seeing is the collapse of the dollar. We saw the same thing under Bush 1. We're seeing it again under Bush 2. It's, you know, welcome to the wonderful world of conservative economics. The Destroy America crowd, the conservatives in Congress and in the White House, ruining our economy, destroying our dollar. So, you know, the rest of the world says, hey, you know, it's going to take more of those less valued dollars to buy our oil.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 33 minutes past the hour, 33 and a half. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's not often that I read old news. I mean, you know, in this business, you always want to be reading the news of the day. By the way, methane is 21 to 23 times more effective at trapping greenhouse gases than is carbon dioxide. Nitrous oxide is 295 times more efficient. HFCs are 12 to 12,000 times more efficient at trapping heat. Perfluorocarbons are 5,700 to 11,900 times more efficient. Sulfur hexafluoride, 22,200 times more efficient. These are some of these man-made chemicals. Thanks to Sue in our chat room, Sue over in the UK, there in Milton Keynes, for digging that stuff out and sharing it with us. And thanks to Scott for the Scott Forrester for the 21 times for methane. It's if you haven't visited our chat room, you're really missing something. There's some really smart people in there. Anyhow, back to old news. I just want to share with you an old news story, because it just illustrates the insanity, the stupidity, or perhaps the villainy of the Bush administration and conservative notion that the commons is something that, screw the commons. We don't need the commons. Take care of everybody. Come on, let the rich stand on their own two feet and let everybody else work 12 hours a day. I mean, that's essentially the conservative mantra. And if they work hard enough, long enough, maybe they'll become rich. And a few will. A very few. So, in the process of carrying this out, then, the two things that they do are reduce the taxes on the rich and reduce services to everybody else. Destroy the infrastructure of America. Our roads are crumbling, our bridges are crumbling, our schools are crumbling. About the only institution that was doing well was our defense establishment. That's crumbling now as a result of Bush's misguided war into Iraq. I really don't believe that he expected this. But when you get back to the larger issue of infrastructure, here's a story from the June 6th of June, 2005. Now, today is what, the 29th of August? Yeah. Today is Monday, August 29. Here's a story that is almost 3 months old. In fiscal year 2006, the New Orleans District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is bracing for a record $71.2 million reduction in federal funding. It would be the largest single-year funding loss ever for the New Orleans District, Corps officials said. The article goes on to say there's an economic ripple effect, too. The cuts mean major hurricane and flood projects will not be awarded to local engineering firms. Also, a study... Now, keep in mind, this is a story from June. Also, a study to determine ways to protect the region from a Category 5 hurricane have been shelved for now. Money is so tight, the New Orleans District, which employs 1,300 people, instituted a hiring freeze last month on all positions. The freeze is the first of its kind in almost 10 years, said Marsha Dema, chief of the Corps Programs Management Branch. Stephen Jeselnik, interim commander of the New Orleans Corps District, told employees in an internal email dated 25 May that the district is experiencing financial challenges. In addition to a hiring freeze, Jeselnik canceled the annual Corps picnic held every June. The House of Representatives wants to cut the New England, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives. I would add, in order to pay for George W.'s tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, wants to cut the New Orleans district budget 21%. From $343.5 million in 2005 down to $272.4 million in 2006. The president had suggested that it only be cut by $50 million. The House wants to cut it by about $60 million. Mary Landrieu, the senator from New Orleans, said the Bush administration is not making the Corps of Engineers funding a priority. She said, "I think it's extremely short-sighted. She said, when the Corps of Engineers budget is cut, Louisiana bleeds. These projects are literally life and death projects to the people of South Louisiana, and they are of vital economic interest to the entire nation. One of the hardest hit areas of the New Orleans district budget is the Southeast Louisiana Urban Flood Control Project, which was created after the May 1995 flood to improve drainage in Jefferson, Orleans, and St. Tammany parishes. SELA's budget is being drained from $36.5 million awarded in 2005 to $10.4 million suggested for 2006 by the House of Representatives and the President of the United States, George W. Bush. Copyright Dolan News Features. MediaWires, excuse me. Yeah. And on another note, with regard to Louisiana and what's going on down there, this article from yesterday's BTC News, more than 3,000 members of the Louisiana National Guard's 256th Brigade serving in Iraq can only watch from Baghdad as Hurricane Katrina bears down on their families and homes in New Orleans and other South Louisiana communities from which they hail. The deployed soldiers and their equipment, which includes high water vehicles, Humvees, and generators, will be sorely missed. They're all in Iraq right now. Yes, they took their high water vehicles to Iraq. Yes, they took their Humvees to Iraq. Yes, they took their generators to Iraq. They will all be sorely missed as Louisiana attempts to prepare for and recover from the historic Category 5 storm. Mississippi and Alabama, the other states under siege from Katrina's second assault on the Gulf Coast, also have guard contingents in Iraq. 3,500 troops from Mississippi's 155th Brigade Combat Team serving near Kabbala and Najaf. 140 Alabama Guard troops left last Sunday, just last Sunday, to join 2,000 other Alabama troops already deployed overseas. Governors throughout the country have watched anxiously as the Guard units they count on to see their states through natural disasters have been called up for service in Iraq, in many cases leaving behind tanks and other heavy armor, while taking with them the kinds of equipment that are most valuable in coping with the aftermath of storms, floods, and earthquakes. President Bush has already created one Gulf wasteland. That would be the Gulf region, the Gulf of Arabia. In a few days, he'll be offering condolences to the residents of another. Real smart. Real smart. It's just so impressive. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Dave in Allentown, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to point out there's an excellent article in USA Today, one of the few excellent articles in USA Today, a full-page article on Chavez that echoes just about everything you've been saying.
Really?
In terms of his generosity towards all of his neighbors in Central America down there, and his ability to sell oil at an affordable rate. And I just take note when someone like this in the world is upsetting this administration, because 9 times out of 10, if they're upsetting this administration, they're no doubt doing the right thing.
Yeah, well, and you know what Bimbo and all the other right-wingers are going to say is, oh, he's just bribing people, he's just buying their votes. Now, when George W. Bush gives $1 billion to the churches in the year 2004, illegally, I might add, in the United States, Congress wouldn't pass the law to do it, so he simply signed an executive order to create this faith-based initiative thing. Gives $1 billion to the churches. He's not buying their votes. But when Chavez gives oil revenue to poor people in his own country and helps out neighboring countries, he's just buying their liking him.
That's exactly right. They're actually referring to it as him building up political capital.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's genuine generosity.
Well, my understanding, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, here, but I thought that in a representative democracy, which, by the way, Venezuela is, Chavez was elected twice to the office of presidency. And last year there was an attempt to recall him, just like they did with Gray Davis in California, and he beat the recall. He won again, so he's won three elections. I always thought that in a Democratic representative, you know, in a republic, a Democratic republic, representative democracy, that the goal of the so-called leaders was actually to represent the people, that is, to do what the people wanted. And if sharing the oil wealth of the nation with the people is what they want, how is that buying votes?
Well, that's interesting that you say that. That's I agree with that. I'm not sure that the article is correct in this assumption, and that and the one part of the article does assume that the majority of the people they're saying are not in favor of him giving this oil away at the price that he is. But I actually find that hard to believe.
It wouldn't surprise me if the people of Venezuela are saying, hey, don't give Colombia our oil, but they probably rather enjoy the fact that they're getting it, or don't give it to Castro, for the example, but they're probably rather enjoying the fact that they have access to it. Thank you, Dave, for the call.
Okay, thank you.
I appreciate it. And the flip side of that, of course, is you have to ask the question, okay, it makes so much sense. Okay, all those years, you know, all the right-wingers were ruling over the radio waves, and they were saying, oh, welfare is just buying votes from poor people. It's just the Democrats' way of buying votes from poor people. Then what's the opposite? What's the opposite? If you just keep all the money and you just let rich people get richer and richer and richer, is that buying the votes of the rich people? If you give huge tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires? Or is it that elected representatives are supposed to do the opposite of what the majority of the people want them to do? Oh, the people want Social Security. Well, that's just buying votes. That's welfare. We shouldn't give them Social Security. So, screw them. But I thought the majority of the people wanted that. Yes, but we've got our conservative philosophy. I thought this was a democracy. Ah, we don't like democracy. We like capitalism. But you can have capitalism in a democracy. It's called a regulated economy. You have to save capitalism from itself. You keep it from destroying democracy. No. We're just all about capitalism. Amazing. Spike in Eastern Pennsylvania. Hey, Spike, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Gonzo greetings, and congratulations to local Estonian Mud Mike from the chat room and what he got published in the Allentown paper.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
It's a lot of Lehigh Valley talk today here. Real quick, in the September 12th issue of the American Conservative, Philip Girardi, the same guy who talked about the neocons going after Iran if we get attacked again, he does a thing in his little deep background talking about the corruption and the rebuilding of Iraq is getting so bad that $5 billion has vanished. $300 million went towards the purchase of stripped-down, useless Polish helicopters.
Yeah.
And all the corruption, and more or less how the top-secret audit from the Department of Homeland Security is showing so much fraud that it's crippling both the reconstruction and self-defense.
Yeah, the last number I saw was actually between $8 and $9 billion in missing funds.
Well, I just get a real kick that, you know, this isn't coming from the, quote, you know, liberal, you know, Democrats who are lying. This is coming from, once again, the world of Scott McConnell, Takathakopoulos, Pat Buchanan.
Right.
And, you know, essentially, they love talking about the oil for food corruption, but here we go. We have the money for useless military items corruption going on in Iraq.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. It's absolutely mind-boggling. Yep.
And also, real quick, Buchanan did an article on that same issue talking about how more or less this Constitution's a joke over there. And he has a great quote that says that a nation makes a constitution. A constitution doesn't make a nation.
There you
which
go.
Is a great point, actually, yeah. Considering who it's coming from.
Yep. Well said, Spike. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Josh in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Josh.
Hey, Tom. I just want to mention the latest issue of Scientific American special issue. You probably get it, but it's Crossroads for Planet Earth. It's got a picture of Earth on the cover with a black background.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of good material in there on the next 50 years.
I haven't seen it. What are they suggesting?
Well, they've got it's comprehensive. It covers population problems, energy solutions, water and wealth, ending poverty, how to save species, and global public health. But I just wanted to point out how upset I am at these stupid right-wingers and at the incredible level of callous disregard and irresponsibility they show for everybody on this planet by not even acknowledging the threat of global warming.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. It's the ultimate insult to all of us, and they deserve to get their comeuppance for it.
Yeah, tragically, though, their comeuppance is going to be ours as well. I mean, we're all in this together. As much as they think that they can hide behind their gated communities and on their private jets and in Donald Trump's penthouse apartment, if New York City floods or if our food supplies are disrupted or if our oil runs out, it happens to all of us.
Right.
It happens.
Well,
it just absolutely happens to all of us.
Thanks, Tom. Love the show.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the call, Josh. Excuse me. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's the illusion that somehow we can just kind of, you know, we'll just step out of this, you know, make a few million bucks and actually maybe 20 million, 50 million, 100 million, and you can insulate yourself from it all. No. Maybe, you know, maybe that's why Paul Allen is so interested in spacecraft. He sees the way the wind is blowing. I don't know. I say that tongue-in-cheek. 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. You ever heard of the straw man argument? Straw man is where you create a fictitious enemy, and then you attack that as a way of changing the subject away from the real issue. And boy, are the cons good at it. It's, you know, Cindy Sheehan is out there, she's saying, what is the noble cause for which my son died in Iraq? And if it's so noble, why have the Bush twins not enlisted in it? Nobody's even addressing that. Instead, they're throwing up all these straw men. Oh, she's a peacenik. Oh, she's got hippies. Oh, she's on her. Michael Moore is quoting her on his website. Excuse me. What's the noble cause? Straw men. Ed in Wilson, North Carolina on the line. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, maybe the Bush twins don't want to go. We still have a voluntary army. But on this issue of global warming, I'm a Republican. I believe there is a global warming issue, and I think that we need to take action to solve it. However, until Barbara Streisand lands her plane, reduces the size of her 40,000-foot mansion, I don't think she has any position to lecture to anybody about use of energy.
That is a great straw man, Ed. I'm really impressed. What a BS argument.
What a pathetic
argument, Ed. Come on, you could do better than that.
It's a fact.
Half of all the carbon burned in the United States is coming from automobiles. You think, and you got to drag Barbara Streisand into this?
Hey, say that again. I missed that part.
Ed, I don't get it, Ed. Why Barbara Streisand? Why not Ken Lay's private jet?
Because they aren't lecturing to me about it. If they have something to say about it, I don't care if you're Democrat or Republican. If you're going to get out there and
lecture
about it,
okay.
What I suggest is...
Ed, hang on. Just calm down, Ed. When did you hear Barbara Streisand lecturing to you about global warming?
She hasn't lectured to me, but I've watched her on C-SPAN give some of these speeches about issues like global warming.
You have heard Barbara Streisand talk about global warming?
I absolutely have on C-SPAN.
And you think that, therefore, because she has a big house, she shouldn't be able to talk about that?
No, absolutely not. I think she should be able to talk about it. But if she's going to talk about it, and she's going to talk about it and garner any type of moral high ground, she needs to say, look, I'm Barbara Streisand. I have a lot of resources at my disposal, but I decide to live in a small house that consumes little power, and I decide to not drive around the country.
You know, Ed, if everything you're saying is true, Ed, I don't disagree with you. Dennis Weaver is a good friend of mine. He's a movie star, and he lives in a house made out of dirt and old tires. Leonardo DiCaprio is a friend of mine. He made a movie out of one of my books, and he drives a Prius, a Toyota Prius, the same car I drive, gets 45 miles to the gallon. You know, I don't disagree with you on that, if that's what's really going on. Then people should walk their talk, sure. But what does that have to do with anything? What does that have to do with the fact that you've got Dick Cheney out there who's supposed to be responsible for our energy policy, instead ripping off us taxpayers and giving those tax dollars to Ken Lay and his friends?
Well, I don't know that they have done that. I mean, I've heard...
You haven't looked at the energy bill?
What I'm saying is this is an energy
times,
bill.
I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Swanigan. Sorry, we got a bogey. 27 years.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Hurricane Katrina is pounding New Orleans as we speak. The Superdome's roof has peeled away in two places, at least part of the roof, although the people inside apparently are still safe. A little bit of rain is getting in on folks, but one of the breaches, they're relatively small, each about 15 to 20 feet long, 4 to 5 feet wide. They're in an area of vents 19 stories above the floor, and somehow the wind got under the vents. But it seems that the 10,000 people in the Superdome are still safe, which is amazing to me. I mean, that's just got to be an engineering marvel. It's remarkable. George Bush is deciding whether or not to release oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Frankly, I'm guessing he will do that to avoid oil shortages. And of course, the high cost of gasoline is hammering him, but he really has 6 months before he has to worry about it politically. And everything that this administration does is done on a political timetable. So, you know, the memory of Americans is relatively short. And this is something Bush himself pointed out, that his father had, you know, an all-time high rating when he invaded Kuwait, when he threw Iraq out of Kuwait, but he ended the war in just 100 hours. And if he had just stretched that war out for another 3 months, George Herbert Walker Bush would have beat Bill Clinton. But he didn't. He finished the war very quickly with very few casualties, which was the right thing to do, but it didn't allow him to be seen as a war president. And no president during time of war has ever failed to get reelected in the United States, and a lesson George W. Bush learned very well. Jane in San Diego's on the line. Hey, Jane.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling regarding the strike that's currently going on with Northwest Airlines. I work for them, and one of my reasons for calling is I want to keep the spotlight on the subject. Mm-hmm. And keep the heat on the subject. I'm outraged, you know, as a union worker, that how blatant the corporation is. I'm upset at the fact that, you know, the weakening of the union and the diminishing rights of the workers. And I'm upset at the fact that no other union group from the company joined in on the strike.
Do you think, now, just for our listeners who you know, may have been on another planet over the last week or so, the mechanics union at Northwest have gone on strike. The company had set aside millions of dollars in anticipation of this.
Correct.
I think it was something like $600,000 per worker they had in a strike fund to hire scabs and bring them in.
Yes.
And to engage in a massive PR campaign against the union, which they're doing.
Exactly. And, of course, you know, the ultimate goal is to bust the union. They never had any intention to negotiate. But what I'm upset about, like you said, is they set aside millions and millions of dollars, not only to hire scab mechanic, but also scab flight attendants in anticipation of this strike. But, yeah, they turn around and tell the workers they are experiencing financial problems and they cannot fund our pension. And the list just goes on, and it's upsetting. And I guess one of the things I would like to hear is any kind of feedback you have and how, you know, just on the subject. I mean, it's outrageous what the company is doing. And
and
it's basically outsourcing of all the airline jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if people realize, even the workers, you know, it's basically outsourcing of our jobs and Walmartization of our jobs.
Yeah, it's absolutely true, Jane. And in fact, a surprising number, I think it's more than half of all the mechanical work being done on American fleet planes now is being done outside the United States. A lot of them are having their mechanical work done in other countries, even. But the large reality here, Jane, is not just that Northwest has done this and that in other times in the history of the United States it would have been illegal what they did, or they would have been stopped by the Labor Department, for example, from doing it.
Yeah.
But that this is really not just a problem of Northwest and organized labor. This is a political problem. Mm-hmm. Let's just really understand that at its core. What we have here is a Republican Party that has been hostile to the interests of labor since the 1880s. I mean, they have been absolutely consistent since the 1880s in supporting big corporations against the average working person. The Republicans fought and succeeded, actually, with the Supreme Court in the 19-teens to do away with minimum wage laws, to do away with child labor laws, to do away with workplace protection laws. The Supreme Court in the 19-teens declared all of those unconstitutional. When Franklin Roosevelt came into power, he succeeded in getting these laws put back on the books. The Republicans have been fighting them ever since. In 1935, Roosevelt got the Wagner Act passed, which allowed fully legal unionization and created the Labor Department to advocate for the interests of workers. Mm-hmm. The Republicans in 1946, largely because of the unpopularity, some problems Harry Truman was having. The Korean War was a very unpopular thing as time went on. I mean, that's basically why Truman left and Eisenhower came in, because the Korean War was so unpopular. But in any case, the Republicans took control of the House and Senate in 1946, and the first thing they did, or one of the first things they did, was pass the Taft-Hartley Act, sponsored by Senator Taft of Ohio, the grandfather or great-grandfather or whatever of the current governor of Ohio, who's embroiled, Republican governor who's embroiled in these scandals. Mm-hmm. And the Taft-Hartley Act said that individual states didn't have to go along with the Wagner Act if they didn't want to, and so we had these so-called right-to-work states emerge where unions were weakened. We've had a century, essentially, of assaults on organized labor, on the right of working people to unionize and to collectively bargain by the Republicans, the Republican Party, and some conservatives in the Democratic Party as well, truth be told. And the problem, therefore, is political, because the only force that will be able to stand up to the incredible power of organized capital, of organized wealth, organized in the form of a corporation, the only force that can stand up to that, that has the ability to stand up to that, is government representing we the people. And right now, that government has been captured, is the captive of those same forces. Corporations control the White House. Corporations control the House, and corporations control the Senate, because corporations control the Republican Party, pure and simple. And so, therefore, the solution to this isn't just to support the boycott of Northwest Airlines or to not fly Northwest in solidarity with the striking mechanics, although that's an excellent idea. And I certainly, just speaking for myself, would not fly Northwest right now because there's a strike going on. But the larger issue is that we have to get these cons out of office. We have a Labor Department right now that's being run by a Secretary of Labor who's openly hostile to the interests of labor. We have a Labor Department that has a website that tells corporations how to outsource jobs to other countries.
This is nuts. It's nuts. I mean, it's union workers against one another. I mean, it's unbelievable the stuff I'm hearing.
Yeah.
That the IAM, our other big union on premise, is hostile because they're upset at the mechanics breaking away the last contract negotiation to AMFA, so they will not support them. I mean, this is outrageous.
Yeah.
And I'm just shocked that other union members that think that because they need to preserve their own interests, that they don't have to join in, because, like you said, this is collective. It's a larger scale. It's collective bargaining. It's power in numbers. I mean, people don't realize that. It just blows me away. And people vote against their own interests. Like you said, it is a political thing. People that would vote for the union members that vote Republican in office. That just shocks me.
Mm-hmm. And the Republicans do this straw man thing. They trot out, if you get a liberal or a Democrat in there, you're going to have gay couples, having sex in the street in front of your house or something. I mean, Rick Santorum, it's gay marriage is the same thing as bestiality. If it's not that, they want to burn the flag. That's what they want to do. They want to burn the flag. And we got to stop them from burning the flag. We can't desecrate the flag. And, they trot out these straw men, these phony arguments. Are these hysterical, these sources for hysteria, and that's what these people are voting on, not realizing that their economic interests are being damaged.
It's just so basic. And I've heard something over the weekend that in Minneapolis, our main hub, that a lot of the scab mechanics came from United. They were laid off mechanics from United. It's amazing that union workers would cross picket line to sabotage another union. I mean, that's so basic. And, that, of course, that's a smaller scale, but I just...
What has happened, Jane, is that a Lord of the Flies world has emerged. A survival of the most vicious world has emerged. And as labor, I mean, consider, in 1947, when Taft-Hartley was passed, 35% of the American workforce was unionized. Labor was a very, very significant force in the United States. For every union job, there's typically an identical non-union job out there that is, you know, drawing the same wages and pay because the union jobs set the floor for wages. And so 70% of the American workforce in 1947 had a pension, had health care, had job security, and was able to raise a family and put, you know, with just one wage earner in the home and you know, put the kids through school and the whole bit. And now we're down to about 8 to 9% of the private workforce in the United States being unionized. So maybe 18% of Americans have that kind of a job. And as a result, because unions have become unionized jobs have become so scarce, it's like now they're such a minority that they're fighting with each other for the crumbs. And it's tragic to watch. It's tragic to watch. And as I said, the solution is not reforming the unions. The solution is not attacking the unions. I mean, obviously, we need to support the unions, and we need to do everything we can to support organized labor in all cases under all circumstances. But far more important is we have to get pro-labor politicians into office and get these politicians who are only interested in the concerns of the wealthy and powerful out of office. They're not doing us any. They're harming this country, frankly. I mean, just at the bottom line, you know, regardless of what you think about this airline or this union or that union, these kinds of policies harm America because without a strong middle class, you can't have democracy. It's just that simple. You end up with an aristocracy and a whole lot of very, very poor people. And that's the direction George Bush is moving this country and his Republican cohorts. Jane, thanks for the call.
Thank you for your time.
You're welcome, and I appreciate you raising the issue, and it's an important one, and we need to keep it on the front burner. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You're right. Too much wealth undermines democracy. Period.
Too much wealth concentrated in too few number of hands.
But however, and FDR had it right back in 35, you know, he called it entrenched greed.
Yeah.
He was right then, and he's more right today.
Yeah. Yeah, but people, unfortunately, people are afraid to talk like that anymore because of 15 years of Limbaugh and all the righties going, class warfare.
We've come to the point, too much is given, much is expected. What I mean by that, and it's not me, the upper middle income people who probably primarily, correct me if I'm wrong, put George Bush back in office.
If in fact, American voters put him back into office, yes.
The upper middle. Too much is given, much is expected. They need to make better choices. They made it make a better choice because eventually it's going to affect them. Right now it may not be affecting them, and they don't seem to much care.
Yeah, but you're quoting, you know, words of Jesus. You're quoting the New Testament. These guys would much rather quote the Ten Commandments in the Old Testament than that stuff from Jesus. I mean, you know, about taking care of the poor. Come on.
Yeah, and then they'll throw, here's what they like to do. I hear the music. They want to say, well, we're against capitalism. No, we're not against capitalism. We're against unbridled capitalism.
Yeah, yeah, that's the thing. It's capitalism, in fact, unbridled capitalism, as you say, and it's a perfect point, Gary. Thank you for the call. Unregulated capitalism will eventually destroy itself. It will become plutocracy and kleptocracy, and we're just about there, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Come together right now over me.
Right. And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Just reading Paul Krugman's piece in the New York Times today about Greenspan's bubble. You really want to know about Greenspan, Alan Greenspan. You really want to know about economics and what's going on in the world economically. Check out the book Greenspan's Fraud by Ravi Batra. It's amazing. Scott in our chat room also pointing out the NOAA.gov, www.nhc.noaa.gov website is the Commons of Weather. And that's the Weather Service, of course, that all of the weather reporters that you're hearing on TV, seeing on TV and hearing on the radio are using. And Ricky Santorum wants to make sure that they can only give their information to private corporations who then sell it to us. So our taxpayer dollars pay for the source material, but we will no longer be able to access it. We will only be able to get it from people making a quick buck off us. Seems wrong, but, you know, hey, it's the Republican way. You know, support the rich, screw the average person. It's just the Republican way. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Yes, I had actually forgotten that that was what Rick Santorum was saying. I remember when I read this a few months ago, I was all up in arms that, you know, the weather should be, if not free, at least we only pay for it once.
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten that. And
yeah. No, they want to make sure that if you want to know if it's going to rain tomorrow, you got to pay somebody.
You know, it's interesting how this hasn't received very much publicity.
Well, I think that's probably because it's not going to go anywhere.
I think you're probably right.
You know, Ricky Santorum, he comes out with, you know, some of the more crackpot Republican things that seem crackpot to the average American, you know, to the rest of us. But to that cult, the conservative cult within the Republican Party, they make perfect sense. You know, turn all of the commons over to private corporations and just let rich people profit from them. No problem. I mean, that's just, you know, that's the world they live in as Ricky flies around on, you know, on some company's private jet, whichever company this week happens to be providing him with his transportation and, you know, for his book tour or whatever. And he looks down on the rest of us and goes, oh, you know, look at the little people.
And speaking of which, prominent Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff has pleaded guilty today to the 6-count federal fraud and conspiracy indictment.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, indeed.
Is he going to get the Martha Stewart treatment, or is he going to get a suspended sentence, or what?
Oh, I think that he's going to get much more than that. I think that the feds are going to go after him in a very serious way. They've been investigating not just this particular fraud, but a whole load of other things, and I think they want to get him, and I think they want to make an example of him.
Hmm, interesting. Interesting. Has he been singing?
No, he has not sung. But though some around him have sung for getting immunity or for getting lesser sentences or for not even being indicted. So there are people who have been talking, and I think he has a certain amount to be worried about.
Is this all going to come back and haunt Mr. DeLay?
Well, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? That's what we're all watching to see. I don't know how closely it's going to touch him. I don't think he's going to end up smelling sweet. I mean, assuming that a guy who's lived his life in the sewers can smell sweet. But I think that it may actually damage him finally with his constituents who may have a certain toleration for corruption but may decide that it's gone too far. Having said that, you know, if he brings home the pork and the bacon.
To his district in Sugar Land,
yes,
Texas.
Yes, he does. He certainly does,
yeah.
Yeah,
and I guess that's, you know, Tip O'Neill's all politics is local. That's the first imperative of politics if you want to get reelected is do good for your district.
Exactly. As Senator Thune has discovered this week, I mean, it was pretty much touch and go for him out there in South Dakota when it looked as though bases were going to close, and his one promise that he made during his election campaign was actually not going to happen. But now that the bases have stayed open, he's probably pretty much short of re-election.
Don't you think that was a foregone conclusion? I mean, you know, I think that there was a lot of political theater here.
I think there's political theater, too, but I think it's been very cleverly stage-managed.
Yeah, to look like, these guys really, these Republicans, they were really at risk of losing their bases, when in fact, come on, they weren't, you know,
yeah.
They weren't.
Sadly, you
same thing
right.
With Gordon Smith here in Oregon, you know, he got his base. Another Republican. Well. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Don't worry about a thing. Every little bit's gonna be all right.
Yeah, it'll all work out. Somehow it always does. If enough of us just talk about what's really going on, hey, wake up! We've got to wake up our friends, our neighbors, get people voting, get them involved. Wake Up America. We have to bring fire, right? Bring the sparks that light an awakening, a revival of democracy in the United States. Step one. By the way, our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. Get the latest iPods and all things Macintosh, all things computer, really. Any sort of computer support or help you need, equipment, whatever, check it out. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, Kevin in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind today?
And I just want to say, you know, if this disparity between rich and poor continues, or the haves and have-nots, the next terrorists that come around will not be Al-Qaeda. It's going to be regular working people. It's already happening throughout Latin America. Prime example, that movie Man on Fire with Denzel Washington.
I didn't see it.
It's about professional kidnappings of affluent people, and the next terrorists, they're going to start striking the golf courses, the gated communities, the Trump Towers.
Yeah.
It happens in Colombia, Bolivia, now.
Oh, I've been there. I've seen it. The last time I was in Bogota, there were several families people that we were meeting with who were supporting a project that we were doing down there, and they were people of some means. I mean, they weren't multi-zillionaires or anything like that. They were people that in U.S. dollars would be, you know, have incomes of the equivalent of maybe $200,000 a year. They were like the upper middle class of Colombia.
Yeah.
And they're the class. That's the class actually that lives in the greatest terror. The multi-millionaires, you know, they travel with five bodyguards in an armored limousine. But the people who are on the high end of the middle, they're scared to death. And we would have to go, you know, through one house, out the back door of another house, down an alley, take a second car to get in or out of their houses so that nobody would know that people were there so that nobody could be kidnapped.
Yeah. But the thing is, you know, even the super rich, you can only have so many bodyguards. One thing, and I quote The Godfather, anybody could be killed. And
yeah, like a JFK.
Yeah. you know, that's just the cold hard truth. And the thing is, it's going to be low-level terrorism through, you know, in the elite restaurants, the theaters, the places where the affluent gather.
So let us hope, Kevin, that it never comes to that in the United States. Although, frankly, it has been like that in parts of this country, you know, regionally through parts of much of the 19th century in various parts of the country, the lawless West and whatnot. You know, you had private armies basically and dueling private armies, and we had a relatively feudal system here in this country for a good chunk of the 19th century. But you're absolutely right. That is the logical end point of Bushonomics, Reaganomics.
Yeah.
And it is that you end up with plutocracy. You end up with a small number of very wealthy ruling families and a whole lot of poor people, and crime explodes. And it is just, you know, it is so well documented. Kevin, thanks a lot for the call.
Okay.
And for raising the issue. I mean, it's a good one. It's just so there. It's just so incredibly transparently obvious, and yet the average person seems relatively clueless about it. You know, just absolutely relatively clueless. They're like, you know, well, you know, I don't, you know, I don't know what's going on. It's really, really, I guess I'm being redundant. I just have to say, we need to be waking people up. You know, the conservative strategy that let's privatize everything, let's do away with the social safety net, this conservative strategy that is animating so much of our thinking does have real consequences. The BBC, back in October of 2002, ran a story and in which they said, and I quote from the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, "The suicide rate increases under conservative governments." Now, this was a study that was done in the United Kingdom and Australia. They did not look at the United States. But I think it's fair to say that there's a parallel. They have the conservative governments, and then they have the Labour Party, the Liberal government. They say, conversely, again, quoting from the BBC, let me just give you three paragraphs here. Conversely, the lowest rates of suicide occurred when state and federal governments were both run by the Liberal Party, the Labour Party. by the Liberal Labor Party. Middle-aged and older people were most at risk. When the conservatives ruled both state and federal governments, men were 17% more likely to commit suicide than when labor was in power. Women were 40% more likely to kill themselves. End of quote. Here's another quote from this research, again, quoting the BBC. Overall, they say, the figures suggest that 35,000 people would not have died in the United Kingdom had the Conservatives not been in power, equivalent to one suicide for every day of the 20th century, or two suicides for every day that the Conservatives ruled. There are real consequences to this. I mean, this is real stuff. This is absolutely real stuff. It's not just some made-up thing. By the way, are we just two votes away from committing our grandchildren to slavery? I mean, Warren Buffett made the marvelous point. He said, yes, of course there's class warfare in America. My class declared it. My class is winning, he said. Warren Buffett, the second richest man in America, behind Bill Gates. And so now we are going to be debating, actually probably there won't be much debate, we're going to be voting on, the United States Senate is going to be voting on, probably Tuesday of next week, when they come back into session, whether 2% of the richest 1% of Americans, that's 0.02% of 1%, should pay estate taxes, a transaction tax on the transfer of wealth from one person to another when somebody dies in their families. Now, if I give you money, you have to pay tax on it if it's over $10,000. And you're a family member. You give a family member over $10,000, you have to pay tax on it. Forget about death if you just do it. But the estate tax, right now, represents over $1 trillion in revenue. Now, given the stakes here, given the amount of money that's involved, and you can, I think, you know, fairly reasonably and accurately assume, guess, realize, know, understand that families like the Walton family, who are funding big time the repeal of the estate tax, what they call the death tax, you know, have a dog in this fight. And they're giving money to Republican politicians like there was no tomorrow. And even a few Democrats. MoveOn.org actually did a piece on this. They pointed out, our federal deficit already exceeds $400 billion. If the estate tax is repealed, millionaires will save another $1 trillion in the first 10 years, and that tax burden will shift to ordinary Americans and future generations. Eliminating the estate tax, they say, amounts to an assault on middle class America, losing over $1 trillion in tax revenue at a time when the federal deficit already exceeds $400 billion. This is a big deal. This is money that right now, this $1 trillion in estate tax money is being used for education, tuition assistance, Social Security, Medicaid. But no, these guys, they would rather average Americans pick this up than Paris Hilton have to pick it up. Let's eliminate the tax. They call it the Paris Hilton fan club, right? Let's eliminate the tax on Paris Hilton. Now, I don't think that there's anybody who is saying that a person who worked hard, made a lot of money, has a lot of wealth, should not be allowed to pass that money along when they die. Some portion of that, so that their family and their children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren and seven generations down the road will be able to live comfortably and even never have to work again. No problem. But let's not pass along such massive estates that those people can influence politics in the United States to the extent that they can get laws written and passed just for them. Then you no longer have democracy. This is what the founders were concerned about. This is why there are no dynasties left over from the founding, from the days of the founders. Currently, only 2% of the wealthiest families in America pay an estate tax. The estate tax does not hurt small farms and businesses. In fact, the Bushies for several years now have been challenged. Find one family farm, please, that actually disintegrated as a result of the estate tax. There aren't any. They talk about these farmers who were affected by the estate tax. Turns out they weren't farmers. They were actually super rich people who in their investment portfolio happened to have a farm someplace that somebody else ran for them. Every single time the cons trot out, well, here's a farm that had to be sold to pay the estate tax. Well, it was some billionaire's estate tax, and yeah, they sold off a bunch of their assets to satisfy the tax, and among it was a farm in another state, run by a family that was, you know, being paid or people, you know, very often factory farms. And they're still farms. Over the next 10 years, $1 trillion. Who's going to pay for that? And here's the interesting thing. Charities. They're not speaking out right now. And the reason that they're not speaking out, you know, even the big ones, the American Red Cross, the Salvation Army, the big charities are not speaking out because they are afraid of antagonizing their donors. They don't want to upset their donors, and so they're being very, very cautious in their use of language and how they speak of this issue. But the reality is that you've got a lot of charities out there that would not exist or whose nature, the nature of their work and the nature of their mission will radically change if you do away with the estate tax. Because one of the ways that people shelter their income from the estate tax is by giving some of it to charity to generate tax deductions so that they can keep the rest of it. Better to give it to a charity that you care about, particularly the political charities, by the way, than to have the government take it in their minds. As Newsweek put it, eliminating the estate tax would, quote, create a new class of landed aristocrats who could inherit billions tax-free, invest the money, watch it compound tax-free, and hand it down tax-free to their heirs. End quote. The estate tax has successfully worked to limit the concentration of wealth and level the playing field in America by ensuring that the richest Americans pay their fair share for close to 90 years. We should be in favor of increasing opportunities for working people, not making it easier for us to have a landed gentry in the United States. In my opinion. And that of many people. So now this is coming before the United States Senate, so please let me encourage you right now to take a moment and call your United States senator and simply say, please vote to keep the inheritance tax. Please vote to keep the inheritance tax. You can reach your United States senators. Every one of us has two of them. You can reach your United States senators by dialing toll-free 1-877-SOB-USOB. SO, like Senate Office Building, United States Senate Office Building, SOB-USOB will get you right through to them. And in the meantime, we have, a new science. Evangelical scientists refute gravity with new intelligent falling theory. The theory of intelligent falling, as the debate over the teaching of evolution in public schools continues. A new controversy over the science curriculum arose Monday in Topeka, Kansas. Scientists from the Evangelical Center for Faith-Based Reasoning are now asserting that the long-held theory of gravity is flawed. And they responded to it with a new theory of intelligent falling. Gabriel Burdett, who holds degrees in education, applied scripture and physics from Oral Roberts University, said things fall not because they are acted upon by some gravitational force, but because a higher intelligence, God, if you will, is pushing them down. He added, gravity, which is taught to our children as a law, is founded on great gaps in understanding. The laws predict the mutual force between all bodies of mass, but they cannot explain that force. Founded in 1987, the ECFR is the world's leading institution of evangelical physics, a branch of physics based on literal interpretation of the body. They say there are many phenomena that cannot be explained by secular gravity alone, including such mysteries as how angels fly, how Jesus ascended into heaven, and how Satan fell when cast out of paradise. They're calling for public school curriculums to give equal time to the intelligent falling theory. They insist they are not asking that the theory of gravity be banned, but only that students be offered both sides of the issue so they can make an informed decision. Burdett says, we just want the best possible education for Kansas's children. That story, by the way, from The Onion. 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 55 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Logan in New York City on the line. Hey, Logan, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I was just wondering what you thought about the suggestion that why don't we Democrats, since the Democratic leadership intends to be a Republican, right, why don't we just all flood into the Republican Party?
Yeah. I think the Republican Party actually, you know, historically has had some people who disagree with us on issues but have been people of good conscience and goodwill. You know, the Barry Goldwaters, the Everett Dirksons, the Dwight Eisenhowers of the world, and Nelson Rockefeller. I wish those people would simply take their party back. You know, I don't think we need to play games with them. I mean, you know, people like my parents who are Republicans, I mean, they're good people. They should be taking back their party. This party has been taken over by right-wing cranks.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, why I bring that up is because it seems like they have taken over this. The people that have taken over the voting is just a small subgroup.
So
they're basically not going to be allowing a certain Republicans to come to power.
Yeah, no, it's happening. I mean, they call them rhinos. You know, you've got a few of them. You got George Voinovich out there and Susan Collins in Maine, but they're very few. They're very few and far between, and they're an oppressed minority, in my opinion. Logan, thanks for the call. I just don't think that I think that we need to be calling on Republicans to take their party back. Phil in Tampa, Florida. Hey, Phil, what's up?
Hey, Tom. As Rush Limbaugh is screaming that the economy is hot as heck, let me report something obviously different. I'm only able to find part-time work, and I work at an assignment to go to different, electronic stores, the Circuit Cities and Best Buys and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I demonstrate a high-definition camcorder. And I can tell you, since the gas prices have gone up, I go every weekend, Saturday and Sunday. I'm there for 4 hours. These stores are dead.
Hmm.
They are dead.
Yeah, people just don't have the disposable income because all of a sudden, you know, they're living on fairly tight budgets to begin with, and now they have to spend an extra $100, $200, $300 a month in gasoline, and
Absolutely.
Boom, that's their discretionary spending, which is what they would have used to buy that camcorder.
Yeah, they're not buying anything. There's nobody in the stores.
Yeah, but Rush Limbaugh is telling the truth. The economy is red hot if you're worth $179 million.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, if you got that kind of money, there are places to invest it where you can do very well, and you only pay a maximum of 15% income tax. So for Rush Limbaugh, the economy is great. For the rest of us, we're toast.
You got it.
Phil, thanks a lot for the call. Oh, my. The cons. It's extraordinary. Just extraordinary. Mitch McConnell. I can't believe he said this. This is a country, certainly by Middle Eastern standards, that's astonishing. While Islam is mentioned, it's not the controlling law of the country. He said this weekend. The Iraqi draft constitution? Islam is the official religion of the state and the basic source of legislation. Ha ha.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 7 minutes, well, 8 seconds short of 7 minutes past the hour. Paris Hilton's inheritance we've covered. I want to get to what's going on in Iraq. We need to talk about Plan B. The Westboro Baptist Church is up to it again. This will boggle your mind. The Iraq Constitution, there's just so much in the news. But Ed in Pittsburgh has been patiently waiting to tell me that I'm wrong. And I always love it when people call to tell me I'm wrong. Hey, Ed.
I didn't say that at all.
Oh, well, that's
I'm
just sorry.
I'm a Tom Hartman fan, and I think you're doing a wonderful job.
Oh, okay. Well, I've...
But other than that, I was listening very intently to your discussion on inheritance tax, and
yes.
There was one thing that came in there, which I believe to be an oversight, and I just mentioned it to your producer, and he insisted that I get on.
Okay.
Anyway, it was the one where you talked about if somebody gives over $10,000, even if it's to their son, they have to pay tax on it.
Right.
Well, that's not true because they can apply it against their lifetime exclusion of $1.5 million each. In other
really?
Words, they just reduced the amount of the exclusion.
How long has that been on the books?
Oh, it's been on it for years.
Huh. Well, I never knew that. That's
well,
amazing because when our kids were going to college...
Well, first of all, it was $10,000, and it was increased to $11,000.
Yeah.
And then if you gave $20,000, instead of having your exclusion of $1.5 million, you had to reduce it by the extra amount that you gave over the $11,000, which is the current amount today.
Yeah, so you can give your kids up to $1.5 million throughout
each,
your life.
You and your wife each can do that.
And it's not so a taxable event.
No, but what you do is you claim it against your exclusion. In other words,
you're claiming it against the exclusion of an inheritance tax. Should you be eligible for that tax?
Right.
I see.
Because you're entitled to $1.5 million.
Right.
Suppose you decide to give them $500,000. Well, if your estate's over $1.2 million, you no longer have $1.5 million exclusion.
Yeah.
You're going to pay it on that extra $300,000 or whatever it is to get you up to that $1.5 million.
In my dreams, Ed. What?
I'm just saying that you don't really have to pay the tax. You
sure.
can apply it against your lifetime exclusion.
Yeah, so then somebody who is not a millionaire...
Well, then he don't have to worry about it.
Okay, so if an average middle-class family wants to give one of their kids an amount of money that they could use for college, for example, and not have that be a taxable event...
Well, what you have to do is if you give over the $11,000, you have to file a gift tax return so that they're aware that you're claiming over... and applying it toward your lifetime exclusion.
I see.
So a gift tax return is required in that respect.
Okay. Well, thank you for informing me. I appreciate it.
Well, like I said, I think you're doing a wonderful job, and keep it up. And like I said, I believe it to be an oversight rather than anything else.
Well, it was just plain old, you know, I don't know the tax code that well. I'm not a CPA.
That's the way it is when you're limited for time.
There you go.
Well, rush things along.
Yeah, and thank you, Ed.
All right, thanks very much.
Good to hear from you.
All right.
Yeah, it's great. You know, well, yeah, okay. I'll be the first to tell you, I am lousy with figuring out tax details. Probably a good thing. I don't know. I just, you know, do it the simple way more often than not. But not having millions of dollars to shelter, I guess I'm not. Anyhow, Article 22.2 of the Afghan Constitution. Now, Afghanistan. Okay, we're talking about Afghanistan. Article 22.2 of the Afghanistan Constitution says, the citizens of Afghanistan, whether man or woman, have equal rights and duties before the law. The new Iraq Constitution not only does not say that, but it says explicitly, and I quote, Islam is the official religion of the state and is a basic source of legislation. No law can be passed that contradicts the undisputed rules of Islam. And, of course, Islam, the same as Christianity has rules in it that says women should be in the back of the bus, their heads should be covered, they should be silent. Well, in Christianity, it's not the back of the bus, it's the back of the church. It's, you know, well, you say, well, it's not a commandment or something. No, Paul wrote it in a letter to, what, the Ephesians, I think? I don't remember exactly where it was now. But, you know, Paul said, you know, women should be, keep their heads covered and keep their mouths shut, basically. And, you know, it's part of Christianity. You've got that in Islam, and only in Islam, you know, it's a little more prominent, particularly in its interpretation anyway, in some of these countries. So now in Iraq, two women who George Bush had trotted out before the elections. Back, remember when Laura was running around, Laura Bush running around, oh, we're going to free the women of Iraq. That's what we're doing. That's why we're there. You know, there's no more rape rooms. By the way, the military still is fighting the release of the photos from Abu Ghraib of our soldiers raping children, teenagers, and adults of both sexes. Anyhow, Laura Bush trotted out these two women, Dr. Raja Kuzai and Iraq's ambassador to Egypt, Sophia Sulai, who sat with Laura Bush at the 2005 State of the Union. What are these two women saying now? One is a member of the Iraqi parliament, the Iraq Assembly. Raja Kuzai, she once called George Bush my liberator, widely reported on all the right-wing talk shows and in the right-wing media like Fox News. And have you, by the way, noticed that ABC News is getting a right-wing spin? The other day, I think it was Friday night on the ABC Evening News, the woman who was reading the news says, liberal Senator Hillary Clinton. I'm like, what? She's not a liberal. And even if she is, that's not her party. She's a Democrat. Why apply labels? And then on, you know, ABC News on the radio the other day, I heard again, it was a woman. I'm sure it was not the same one, but and this is not an indictment of women on ABC. It's just a coincidence, I'm sure. But the commentator said something to the effect. I'm trying to remember the exact phrase. I can probably get it close. Cindy Sheehan, who met with George W. Bush back in, you know, and gave the date, blah de blah, is still down in Crawford, Texas, demanding a second meeting with George W. Bush. The president is not inclined to meet with her. Well, in fact, Cindy Sheehan is down in Crawford, Texas, asking George W. Bush to answer the question, Mr. Bush, for what noble cause did my son die? And if it's such a noble cause, why have your daughters not enlisted in it? Anyhow, these two women, Raja Kuzai and Sophia Suhail. Raja, who, as I said, called George W. Bush my liberator, has now said that the future of Iraq is going to be so bad for women that she's leaving. She's packing up. She's getting out of town. To quote her, Raja Kuzai, Dr. Raja Kuzai, a member of the Iraqi National Assembly, I wanted Iraqi women to be free, to be able to talk freely, and to be able to move around freely. I am not going to stay here. She's leaving town. She can see the handwriting on the wall. Iraq's ambassador to Egypt, Safiya Suhail, who sat next to Laura Bush at the 2005 State of the Union address when George W. Bush mesmerized America with his lofty rhetoric written by several of the best speechwriters money can buy, about how we're spreading democracy, freedom's on the march. Actually, he doesn't use the word democracy anymore. You will notice that. It's been probably 6 months at least since George W. Bush has used the word democracy. He uses the word freedom. Why? Well, number one, he doesn't believe in democracy. And number two, democracy sounds too much like democratic. which is the name of the opposition party in the United States. There is no Freedom Party, so he calls it Freedom. But in any case, the ambassador to Egypt from Iraq, from Iraq, an Iraqi, Safia Sahail, sat next to Laura Bush at the 2005 State of the Union. She said, quote, "Women have lost all the gains we made over the last 30 years. It's a big disappointment." Yes. Contrary to what those who are so misinformed that they haven't been paying attention will tell you, in 1990, Iraq was one of the most progressive, socially progressive countries in the Middle East. Now, that's not saying a lot. There was no political dissent. You could not speak out against Saddam Hussein. Keep in mind, in 1990, Saddam Hussein was our ally, officially. In 1989, Don Rumsfeld, as representing the Bush administration, went over and shook hands with Saddam Hussein. Right after the Kurds got gassed in the war with Iran. Gas we were providing him with. But it was one of the most progressive. Now, the reality is that if you speak out in Saudi Arabia against the administration, against the regime, you can be put to death. You will certainly be arrested and tortured. If you speak out in Egypt against the regime, you will be arrested and tortured. If you speak out in Jordan against the regime, if you speak out in Syria against the, if you speak out in Iran, just right across the board. Dissent in most countries in the Middle East is not tolerated. It was not tolerated in Iraq. But in most of those other countries as well, women are under the veil and under the thumb of men, and they don't have rights, and they can't vote, and they don't get access to free public education, and certainly not free college education, and they can't become doctors and lawyers and other professions. And in Iraq, they could. You couldn't have a political opinion in Iraq, just like you can't in Saudi Arabia, you can't in Jordan, you can't in... perhaps Qatar is a little different, but you can't in most of the Middle Eastern countries. You couldn't in Iraq either. But if you were a woman, you could walk around in jeans, you could walk around with your head uncovered, you could go to work, you could go to school, you could be a doctor, you could work on male patients as well as female patients. The Nazi police, in Saudi Arabia, I think they're called the decency police, the morality police. They did not attack women in Iraq. Now they are. They drive down the streets with bottles of acid and throw them in the face of women who are unveiled. Throw them on the legs of women who are showing their legs, who are wearing dresses. It is forbidden. And now the very women who were sitting next to George W. Bush and who were calling him my liberator are leaving town. They're getting out of town. Amazing. Iraq, Afghanistan, two countries now where the women are, you know, heading to be back in the burqas. They already are in Afghanistan. The wonders of the Bush administration. 20 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism, but we still got terrorists here living in the USA, the big CIA, the Bloods and the Crips and the KKK. But if you only have love for your own race, then you only leave space to discriminate, and to discriminate only generates hate.
And welcome back, 25 minutes past the hour. I'm not sure I agree with all the words in that bumper there. I'm just not going to go along with it. Anyhow, welcome back. Glad to have you with us. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. I'm Tom Harbin. Our program brought to you this hour by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, M-A-C-S, 511-M-A-C-S, and by Motor Silk, 1-866-LESS-FUEL, or evergreenamerica.com, product I use in my automobile, Motor Silk, 1-866-LESS-FUEL. Ed in Santa Cruz, California, on the line. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hi, Tom. By the way, it's really great to hear you on the air here on Monterey Bay.
Oh, thank you. I'm really pleased to be there on KRXA.
That's right.
Yeah.
great new station. And I just wanted to tell you, you talked about how ABC characterized Hillary as a liberal, and I think that's minor compared to another change that's happening, and I just noticed it a few days ago. First, I noticed that on CNN, they no longer put, when they have a talking head, one of the senators or congressmen or women, they no longer put Democrat or Republican after their name. And so you find, and they're interviewing them on their news program, and you find yourself kind of wondering what they are. And it used to be that if you saw that, you could either make a judgment of, yeah, that's a straight party line on either side, or, hey, here's somebody that thinks for themselves, but they're taking that away now. And then I started noticing it on CBS, and I think on ABC as well. And I think there's been some change in their general rules, and they probably pass it around to all their fellow networks.
You know why?
Why?
They're doing this because, this is just my guess, but, you know, I've been inside this business for a while. My guess is that the reason that they're doing it is because Republicans are starting to dissent from the Republican line. And it, when Chuck Hagel, for example, says this is a new Vietnam, if he says that with an R under his name and everybody's going, whoa, a Republican said that, then, you know, it creates a, it's like a thunderclap across the United States. Whereas, if Chuck Hagel says that and there's no R after his name, the average American who doesn't pay close enough attention to politics to know what party Chuck Hagel is from, unless they happen to be from Nebraska, is going to hear him say that and go, ah, another Democrat, eh, you know, like that.
I think that's true, and also there used to be a thing called the Fairness Doctrine, and they tried to balance Republicans and Democrats. And my perception is that really they want to have the majority Republicans on right now.
Yeah.
And so now they don't have to account for it if they do this.
That's true. That's true. That's another good point.
So I think we ought to call them on it.
Well, yeah, you can write letters to each one of the networks. You can call the executive producers or the producers. All that information is typically on their websites. They're not inaccessible. And don't despair if you don't get a response to your email. That doesn't mean it's not being read.
It's always surprising that you do get interesting responses.
Yeah, very often you do. Most people, the simple reality is that most people don't take the time and effort to send an email.
Actually, the truth is I was surprised I got a couple of interesting responses from you.
Yeah, well, I answer my email, at least I read all my email.
Even while you're on the air.
Yeah, I don't answer all of it. Because a lot of things are, you know, here's an interesting link or here's a tip or something like that. And it's like, yeah, cool, thank you. But, you know, it's just I get 200-300 a day. Sometimes I just don't have the time to compose a reply to everyone, but I try to.
Well, keep up the good work.
Yeah, thanks, Ed. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you.
Bye.
Yeah, interesting. Well, speaking of, as we were a few minutes ago, speaking of women's issues in Iraq, the Taliban in Afghanistan, the rise of Islam in Iraq, the subtext to it all, repress women. Diminish the rights of women. Now, this, you know, fits right in with the Bush administration prescription for America. So it should be no surprise that here in the United States, the Bush administration wants to say that Plan B, which is not a contraceptive drug, it is a birth control drug, that Plan B should not be allowed to be sold over the counter in pharmacies. It's a little bit of a debate here, and the guy, you know, this fellow who became the head of the FDA had originally told Hillary Clinton, his name is Lester Crawford, had originally told Hillary Clinton and Patty Murray, a Democrat of Washington, that he would have all this straightened out by September 1st. Turns out, he lied. I'll give you a little more on that right after this. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
What was it you wanted? Tell me again so I know. What's happening in there? What's going on in your show?
Well, I'll tell you, Bob, we're talking here about the status of drugs available for women. On Friday, this from the Center for American Progress, the Food and Drug Administration indefinitely postponed. Now, the indefinitely part seems to have escaped a lot of news reports. indefinitely postponed its decision on whether the emergency contraceptive Plan B, more commonly known as the morning after pill, could be sold to women without a prescription. Now, this is a drug that prevents, used to be thought, that it prevented the embryo, a fertilized embryo, from implanting itself in the wall of the uterus. That was the assumption, used to be. Then they did the science, and just last year they discovered that it actually prevents the contraception, or it prevents the fertilization of the embryo in the first place. So the egg is never fertilized by the sperm. It prevents that from happening. It does it with a, you know, fairly high spike of hormones for just a very short period of time that just, you know, says to that egg, hey, I'm out of here. But the right-wing group Family Pack Federal in USA Today today says this is a good thing that the FDA under Lester Crawford, the commissioner of the FDA, that the FDA has decided to indefinitely postpone this decision about whether or not Plan B should be something that people can buy over the counter. You'd have to go to the pharmacist and ask for it. And in fact, you would even have to prove that you were 18 years old to ask for it. But if you were 18 years old and or whatever the age of consent is on in your state, perhaps, I'm not sure if it's one or the other. I think it's 18 years old. Yeah, it's 18. Yes. If you were 18 years old or over, you could say, hey, you know, here's my ID. I'll take one of those Plan B pills, please. And they would sell it to you. Because it's just birth control. Even though it's taken the day after. The simple reality is that when people... See, this is what most people don't know. They weren't paying attention in sex ed class. When people have sex is not the moment of conception. It takes 2, 3, 4 days for those little sperm with their little tails to swim all the way up into the fallopian tubes where they fertilize the egg. And so if you take the morning after pill, literally the morning after, it shuts that process down. And no fertilization ever occurs. This is called contraception. This is birth control. This is not an abortion. Now, there is a pill out there, RU486, that causes an egg that has already been fertilized and attached itself to the wall of the uterus to, it basically induces a menstrual cycle. That causes the whole thing to just get flushed out. If it happens during the first few weeks of pregnancy, it produces a miscarriage, essentially. That is an abortifacient. That is the pharmaceutical equivalent of a very, very, very early term abortion. But the morning after pill, Plan B, is not an abortion pill. It is a contraceptive pill. It is birth control. It prevents pregnancy from happening. It prevents the egg and sperm from getting together. Since 1999, more than 70 leading medical and public health groups, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, say it is safe and should be available without a prescription and without any age restrictions. Why without a prescription? Because you have to take it within 72 hours of having had sex. Because that's how long it takes for the sperm to get up into those fallopian tubes and go, ah, there's an egg. I got it. And if you don't take it within those 72 hours, it doesn't work. And most people cannot get a doctor's appointment within 72 hours. Can you imagine the chaos that you'd have all over America? If people who wanted to use this for contraception, they're calling the doctor's office. I had sex last night. I got to see the doctor today. Well, I'm sorry. We have an appointment a week from Thursday. No, it's got to be today. So they said, you know, make it so that you have to ask somebody. How about a pharmacist? A pharmacist is a real live person. He's looking you in the face, or she, looking you in the face and saying, yeah. By the way, did you know that if you are taking whatever, if you're taking hormones to deal with something or other that maybe you shouldn't, you know, I mean, certainly there have to be contraindications for this. So you've got a real pharmacist looking at, you know, dispensing a real drug. What's the big deal? Well, the big deal is that the real agenda of many people, not all, but many people within the anti-abortion movement, the real agenda is that they actually want control of women's bodies. They want control of women's lives. There are a bunch of little splinter factions within the anti-abortion group. There are the people who are hysterically worried that there are not enough white babies being produced. And you'd be amazed at how large that bunch is. And every time Newsweek runs some article about how, okay, in California, white people are now in the minority, and you know, within 15, 20 years in America, it's going to be that number just, you know, hysteria, right? There's a bunch of them. And then there's the traditional Catholic line of, we got to have more Catholics in the world. Go out and have a baby for the mother church. We're running low on priests. Have some male babies, please. And then there's, I think, the largest faction, the largest chunk. Well, and then there's, of course, there are some people who are just kind of grossed out by the idea of abortion. They think that if a fetus is a proto-human, a human being, and should not be, to use their language, killed. And the Supreme Court, by the way, has agreed with them, if you're talking about the third trimester, and only under extraordinary circumstances in the second trimester. It's interesting. If you look in the Bible, it says that basically we become human when we take our first breath. Spirit and breath are the same word. It used to be believed, it is believed, and it's that when you take your first breath after birth, that's when the spirit enters you. But don't tell the anti-abortion people that. They don't like you quoting the Bible. Anyhow, so we've got, a lot of these folks, a good chunk of the anti-abortion movement are not just about trying to stop abortions. What they're about is trying to control the lives of women, trying to make sure that there's more white babies, trying to make sure that there's more Catholic babies out there, or Protestant, or Seventh-day Adventist, or whatever particular religion they happen to be a part of. And so they're as opposed to contraception as they are to abortion. But it's very difficult to go out in this day and age and say that they're against birth control pills and they're against condoms. Because it's kind of a done deal. Right? We have birth control pills and we have condoms, and you're going to have a heck of a time trying to stop them. So along comes Plan B, and it's just another birth control pill. But they're going to take that on. This is the beginning. This is the camel's nose under the edge of the tent. So anyhow, in USA Today, this right-wing group, the Family PAC Federal, says this is a wonderful thing. They say hardworking that the FDA has postponed indefinitely this decision. They say hardworking and overstressed pharmacists would be turned into bartenders trying to determine a woman's age and identification. Welcome to the world of teenage fake IDs, Walgreens. Well, gee, that sounds like why should we ask pharmacists to check IDs? I mean, who wants to add that extra burden to them? It's going to slow down the line when I'm waiting for my prescription. Makes sense, right? Except for the fact that pharmacists already have to check IDs for several different substances, including some cold medicines that contain often abused ingredients. There are things out there that pharmacists have to check IDs for already. So, what you gonna do? Well, they're gonna continue with their big lie strategy. They're gonna continue saying, well, you know, et cetera, et cetera. In the meantime, Fred Phelps is out, the Westboro Baptist Church. Yeah, good old Fred. I remember when I lived in Vermont, walking downtown in Montpelier, and there's the state capitol there, and this was when Howard Dean was the day that he was going to sign the civil unions bill. And there's this bunch walking around with their signs, God hates gays, you know, blah de blah. Well, they showed up at the funeral of two Tennessee soldiers who were killed in Iraq. I am not kidding you. They showed up at the funeral of two soldiers from Tennessee who were killed in Iraq and marched around with signs saying, God hates fags and God hates you. In their news release, they said, God is punishing American soldiers for defending a country that harbors gays. That's why our soldiers are dying in Iraq, is because we allow people in the United States to be gay. Or at least to openly be gay. Now, obviously, these people haven't looked at the biological research that finds that anywhere from 4 to 8% of pretty much every mammal species is gay. There are gay sheep, there are gay rats, there are gay mice. You know, pick a mammal, you will find gay members among them. Nobody's really sure why. It's one of the great debates going on in science. But there's clearly a biological basis for this. Maybe it has something to do with intelligent design. Now, see, if people are really born gay, then the intelligent design folks would have to, they'd have to say, well, okay, must be God's will. I could see a new coalition forming. Intelligent design creationists in support of gay rights in America. Makes sense to me. Well, when hell freezes over, I know. Yeah. Lawmakers are drafting proposals. This is from the Washington Post yesterday. Lawmakers are drafting proposals that would cut billions of dollars from the growth of Medicaid, slice into student loans just as students return to college, pare back food stamps, and trim farm price supports in the middle of a Midwestern drought. Just, I would add, as this country slides into a very severe recession, perhaps even a depression that's going to be brought about by the confluence of massive debt, massive deficits, the result of George W. Bush's tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. Massive trade deficits, the result of Bill Clinton signing NAFTA and GATT and creating the World Trade Organization and our so-called free trade policies. And it's not all Bill Clinton's fault. You know, Ronald Reagan started it. George Herbert Walker Bush sped it up. But Bill Clinton kicked the door open. And the rise in oil prices. And the bubble of the housing market. I mean, we're riding now into a perfect storm. Mark my words, the next year or two are going to be really, really rough. So what's the response of the Republicans in Congress? Let's shred the social safety net. Let's make it so that the only people who have any security are the extremely rich. If you earn your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, you only pay 15% income tax. No, they passed that one with the last tax cut. Jonathan Weissman in the Washington Post notes the raft of bills due out of 16 committees in the House and Senate by the 16th of September will present the Republican Party its toughest test of fiscal austerity in nearly a decade. Oh, it's fiscal austerity, is it? I thought fiscal austerity was not cutting taxes when you have a war on and you can't afford to do it. The impact of the bills will be broad. The Energy Commission committees will produce legislation to open Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling to secure $2.4 billion in royalties and other payments. The Senate Finance Committee is trying to find as much as $10 billion in savings from Medicaid. Grandma needs her medicine. She needs to be able to see the doc. Tough! When states such as Tennessee and Missouri are throwing tens of thousands of people off their Medicaid rosters, I saw a great ad the other day. It showed a photo of a little girl taking a hit off an inhaler, you know, one of these asthma inhalers. And the headline said something to the effect of, if she's treated with Medicaid, her medicine costs $15. If she's treated in a hospital emergency room, her medicine costs $635. See, the answer that the cons will give you is, well, everybody in America can get health care. You can always show up at the hospital emergency room. And yes, you show up at some big city hospital emergency rooms, and you'll see the truth of that. There is, in some cases, a two-day wait. People camping out in the emergency room to see a doctor. But at what cost to society? Anyhow, on it goes. The Senate Agriculture Committee will try to trim farm price supports by $2.5 billion, cutting $7 billion from the federal student loan program. What? We want to be competitive with the rest of the world? Nah, we're Republicans. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Here they come again. Catch us if you can.
I see this is great. In the Marion Delgado in the chat room, a new name for a Hummer SUV, a stretch Hummer. One of the houses that I walk by when I walk home has a Hummer out in front of it. I've never been that close to one, to just walk by and look in. They are the weirdest things. I mean, they're like small tanks. I mean, it's just downright strange. Anyhow, Marion Delgado says, for a stretch Hummer, you know how they always come up with a name for cars? This one should be called the Oligarchy. Yeah, I like it. Yes, if you want the real wit and wisdom, tune into the chat room. Go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. Medicaid is going to be the largest target of the cons as Congress comes back into session, by the way. Even with the tax cuts, the program will grow from $184 billion this year to $250 billion. Now, for some reason, the Washington Post doesn't say over what period of time that is. Is that over the next year, over the next 5 years, over the next 30 years? I don't know. The budget resolution mandated that the Senate Finance Committee produce legislation that would carve $10 billion out of entitlement programs under its jurisdiction. Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa, is hoping to find all $10 billion of that in Medicaid. But committee and Senate leadership aides say divisions in the panel may force him to lower that Medicaid target. Instead, some savings will have to come from Medicare and welfare programs. Record high gasoline prices should make it easier for them to pass laws accessing the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve. Yeah, I'd say Anwar is pretty much toast. In the meantime, speaking of bizarre, as they say, speaking of truly bizarre...
We interrupt Tom Hartman with this John Bolton alert.
Yes, so the verdict seems to be in. John Bolton's charm offensive is proving every bit as effective at the UN as it was in the Senate, which President Bush had to bypass to install him as ambassador. This is from the Think Progress blog. Oh, no, this is from Huffington Post, excuse me. As the London Independent put it, any hopes that John Bolton, the new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, would have been chastened by the way he was elevated to his position have been dashed by the emergence of a leaked document detailing his negotiating demands for next month's U.N. summit. And it turns out that he's been at it again, chopping out from U.N. documents language about getting AIDS drugs into Africa, stopping global warming... You know, pretty much anything that contradicts the corporate agenda that he and the Bushies are so wed to. It's really, really quite startling, quite tragic, actually. And the whole world is watching, going, why is America trying to sabotage good works? Why? It's Bolton.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
We'll see you tomorrow.